what is actually a preliminary practice. For example, if you engage in any kind of activity, first you do some preparations in order to be able to do that activity. And it is the same for the Dharma. First we study, we learn about the Dharma, and then we practice it. And finally we attain enlightenment. So in the Kagyu lineage, for example, we have this practice called Mahamudra. And in this lineage, we practice the fivefold path of Mahamudra. And in order to practice the fivefold path, there are certain preliminary practices that we have to undergo. And then after we have completed those preliminaries, then we gradually practice the fivefold path. The fivefold path are like five essences of crucial importance. And so these are like the main part of the practice. And the preliminaries are the foundation. And if you do not have a preliminary foundation, it's hard to practice the actual main practice. For example, it's like when you build a house, first you need a foundation. If you do not have a foundation, you can't build a roof. Only after you have a foundation can you build a roof. And so similarly, first you have to learn about the Runro, the preliminaries. What is the preliminaries? How do I practice it? What's the point? What's the benefit? And once you understand all of that, you actually engage them. So for the preliminaries, there are different levels, the common, uncommon, and the special preliminaries. So we first have the common preliminary practices, and these are called common because they are practiced commonly throughout all the Buddhist traditions, whether it is the Hinayana, the Mahayana, or the Vajrayana. And these are the preliminaries, a foundation that is necessary for all other practice. So first, when we begin with the common preliminaries, we refer to them as the four thoughts that turn the mind. And the reason why we reflect on them is because we have a very strong attachment to this life. We are attached to samsara, and we believe in the reality of samsara. We don't understand the true nature of samsara, of this life. And so because of this attachment and belief in reality, we wander in circles in samsara. And due to that, we are unable to practice the Dharma. We are unable to give up non-virtuous actions. And we are only preoccupied with the activities of this very lifetime. And then we are attached to anything in this life, to our family members, to our friends, to our money, our possessions, and so forth. And with that strong attachment, we are always unable to give up what we should give up and to do what we should do. And for as long as we do that, we are never liberated from samsara. And not being liberated from samsara, we always experience suffering. And we continue to wander in the six realms of samsara. So first we reflect on the four thoughts that turn the mind. For example, we understand karma, cause and effect. We understand, for example, that all the happiness in this life is the result of virtuous actions committed in the past. And all the suffering in this life as well is the result of negative actions we have committed in a previous life. So we understand that all of our experiences of happiness and suffering are our karma. And also this body, when we look at our body, we understand that it is just a temporary occurrence. It is impermanent, and also it has the nature of suffering. So when you really understand that, you will first of all develop a sense of fear towards samsara. And then you recognize that it is not that there's anything good in samsara. It is just that I'm attached to samsara. But actually, there is no happiness. There is only suffering. Samsara has no essence. So when you understand that, then you will turn your mind away from samsara. You develop renunciation. You will be inspired to practice virtue and to give up negative actions. So the four thoughts that turn the mind means we are turning the mind away from the attachment to samsara. So these are methods to turn the mind away from attachments by understanding the reasons. So you probably all have the text on the preliminaries. So we are starting on page 16. So it says, in the text, now that I have found the precious human body with freedom and connection, which will be difficult to find again, I must practice to attain the state of unsurpassed enlightenment for the benefit of others. So now we have found the precious human body, and this is the time where we have to listen and reflect and meditate and practice. Listening means first we receive the teachings from our teacher. We need to listen to them well, keep them in mind, think about their meaning, understand their meaning, and then put it into practice. Do what we should do and give up what we should give up. We have found the precious body with all the freedoms and advantages, and it's very hard to find such a body. We often speak about there's 8 freedoms and 10 advantages, but we don't have the time to go into detail now. But in brief, of the 6 realms of samsara, we have found the best of bodies, which is a precious human body. It is very hard to find this body, and we know that in terms of numbers, examples, and illustrations. And now is the time that we need to have an opportunity to engage in practice, to listen to the Dharma teachings and so forth. So it would be a waste if we would not practice at this time, if we would not study and do what we should do and give up what we should give up. Because in the future, it is very unlikely that we will find such a precious human body again. So now we have found it. Now is the time where we have to listen, reflect, and meditate. Gambopa had said in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, the support is the precious human body. And so in order to attain the state of enlightenment, we need a support, a kind of a working basis. And the working basis, the support, is a body. And the only body that can bring us to enlightenment is the human body. And therefore it is said that it is the best of the 6 realms of samsara. Because the sentient beings in the 3 lower realms have no way of understanding karma. They have no way of knowing what to do and what not to do. They just do not have the favorable conditions to practice the Dharma. And then the gods and the demigods in the higher realms, they are distracted by temporary pleasure and happiness. So they also do not practice the Dharma. As a human being, we have happiness, but we also have some suffering. And we also have a wish to be happy, and we have a wish to be free from suffering. So that is the perfect condition in order to engage in the practice of the holy Dharma. So now we have found the precious human body, but we have not just found it for no reason. All sentient beings in the 6 realms of samsara are born in their specific bodies as a result of actions that they have committed. And so, for example, an insect also wants to be happy. That's we all share in common. And the insect also wants to be free from suffering. But then due to its karma from the past, it has this insect body now. It has a specific body. So for this reason, it does not have the conditions to practice the Dharma. So the insect wants to be happy, but it doesn't know how to do that. And it doesn't want to suffer, but it doesn't know how to avoid suffering. So now we should think that I have found this precious human body. I have an ability to do all of that. So first of all, it is due to a connection that I have already had with the Dharma in a previous life. That is why I have found this human body. And also it is because in a previous life, I have practiced pure morality. I have practiced the 6 paramitas. And I have sealed these practices with a pure aspiration. And that is essential. Because there are a lot of human beings in this world, in the various countries, but we cannot say that they all have a precious human life. Only very few actually enter the holy Dharma. So all of those human beings first have created the causes for being born as a human. They have practiced the 6 paramitas to varying degrees and morality, and as a result now they are human beings. But then they have had various motivations, pure and impure. And that determines whether or not they meet the Dharma in this life. So we have met with the Dharma, and that is the result of having made a pure aspiration in the past, of having had a pure connection to the Dharma in the past. That is why we are now have the opportunity to meet the Dharma again and to practice the Dharma. So we are very fortunate. So we have this precious human body with the 18 freedoms and advantages, and that is the result of great merit we have accumulated in the past. And therefore, it is extremely valuable. It is very precious. So then we have to think about the future. What we achieve in the future, what kind of body we find in the future, whether it is enlightenment or birth in the Pure Land or whether we are born as a human being or in the lower realms, is in our hands right now. It depends on whether or not we engage in practice and study. So for this reason, this is a very significant time, because with this body we have an opportunity to actually accomplish enlightenment. So if you understand that, then you will do whatever you can to practice virtue and to give up non-virtue. For example, this human body is like a ship that helps you cross an ocean. Without a ship, you can't cross the ocean. You will drown in the water. But if you use this ship properly, you will reach the other shore. So similarly, if you use this body to engage in Dharma practice properly, you can become liberated from the suffering of samsara. For example, it's also like a car. If you want to buy an expensive car, first you have to work hard, you have to make money, and then you finally can buy the car. Then when you buy the car, you will want to take good care of it. You don't want to throw trash all over it and just spoil it. That would be a waste. Once you bought a nice car, since you worked so hard for it, you want to take good care of it, you want to use it, you want your family to use it. Then the car has become useful. And so similarly, if you use this precious human body to practice virtue and to give up non-virtue, you have made good use of it. If not, if you use this human body to engage in negative actions, then it is like throwing trash all over your car. So this human body is very significant because it is like a cross-section that determines whether you will go up or down. This human body will either lead you to the higher realms and enlightenment, or it will throw you down into the lower realms. And that's a very crucial point that we must understand. So understanding that crucial point, the crucial circumstance that we are in this human body, we should make the greatest effort to apply ourselves in Dharma practice. Then the next verse on impermanence says, on seeing that the hostile lord of death may strike my precious life at any time, I shall consider the impermanence of others and myself. So this precious life, we just mentioned before, is the precious human body. And so it is like a precious wish-fulfilling jewel. It is precious because whatever we request of a wish-fulfilling jewel, it will grant us our wishes. And so the human body is very similar to that. If we use it to practice virtue and to give up non-virtue, it will bring us to the state of enlightenment. That is why it is so precious. So this hostile lord of death here means that we can die at any moment. We are always in danger of dying. At any moment, like, death is waiting for us. We don't know when we are going to die, but we are always ready to die. So can we be so certain that we will not die today or next year or in the next 20 years or 30 years? We just don't know it. But we are ready to die at any moment. It's possible to die today. It's possible to die tomorrow. Now, when we think about that, we see that actually it is just that I'm so attached to this life that I forget about that. Actually, I could die at any time because everything is impermanent by nature. When we look back at our parents or ancestors, or this world, there are hundreds and thousands and billions of people who already have all died. They all have passed away. And it is just a question of time until anyone will die. Anyone in this world who is alive now will die. And everyone who will be born in the future also will not transcend death. So everything is impermanent by nature. When we think about impermanence, we think about the outer impermanence of this world or the inner impermanence of sentient beings, the impermanence of others and oneself. But in brief, everything that is born is going to die. And when impermanence arises in our mind, that means that we really are aware of it. We know that I'm going to die. And generally, of course, that's something that we all do know. Everyone knows that we are going to die. But we try to avoid that thought, and so therefore it is not a very powerful feeling in our mind. And due to that, we are distracted by our samsaric activities. We think about what am I going to do tomorrow. We're making a lot of plans for next year, for the next few years. But nobody is actually making any plans for one's death. We are only making plans for our survival. Nobody thinks about dying. We are making plans for the next few years. It's all lined up. Nobody thinks about death. And the problem with that is that we then never sincerely engage in Dharma practice. We do practice the Dharma, but kind of on the side, a little bit here. If we have the time, then we practice a little bit of Dharma. But for the most part, we are preoccupied with our normal activities. And why? It is because I am attached to samsara, because I do not really think about impermanence. If I would think about impermanence, then the first plan I would make is my own death. I don't know when I'm going to die, but before that, I am going to practice. I am going to take refuge in the three jewels, practice the preliminaries. I'm going to complete Vajrasattva. I'm going to practice the mandala. I'm going to complete the guru yoga. I'm going to practice the preliminaries step by step. So that's the lineup for a practitioner. We are not thinking about what am I going to do in this world in 3 years. Our lineup of activities is not worldly, but it is turned toward the Dharma. So for that, first you understand how difficult it is to find a precious human body. And then you think about how impermanent this life is, that you're ready to die at any moment. So then you would, knowing that, you would think about future lives. You would line up your activities based on future lives. So actually, if you really understand karma and impermanence, your lineup of activities, your plans would be geared towards the next life. You would make plans of how am I going to practice virtue, how am I going to abandon non-virtue, how am I going to prostrate, practice Vajrasattva, practice mandala. That's your lineup. And so, of course, we can still have a lineup in terms of samsaric activities, but at the same time, we also must have kind of a lineup of plans in terms of Dharma activities. So this thought about impermanence is like an encouragement for us to engage in practice. And so sometimes people see it as something negative. They say that the Buddhists talk a lot about negative things. They try to make us feel scared, talking about death and morbid things like that. But actually, it is really the reality, and it happens to everyone. Even though we don't really want to hear it and listen to it, we don't want to talk about it, it does happen to everyone. And it's therefore only of a benefit for us to think about it. And there is no harm. Because if you understand impermanence, then naturally you will not be so attached to this lifetime. And if you're not so attached to this life, you will also not suffer so much. For example, there's a lot of people who commit suicide. For example, they lose their business or they lose their companions and they're overwhelmed by suffering. For example, now why are they doing that? Why are they so overwhelmed and then commit suicide? It's because really they don't understand the significance of this life and impermanence. They are very much attached to this life, actually. So then if anything happens today that you do not want, something unsatisfactory happens today, then you are overpowered by difficulties. On the other hand, if you understand impermanence, you will not see it, you will not think that it's such a big deal, whatever happens. Then even if there is something terrible happening today, you will not suffer so much because you understand impermanence. And even if you are very fortunate and you find, for example, a precious object, you will not be so attached to it. You will not feel that I have found this wonderful thing. You will not be very attached to that. You know that I have it now, but I won't always have it because everything is impermanent. And not even just the object, even my own body is impermanent. I will lose all of that. So since I'm going to even lose my body, there is no need to talk about material things or people. So actually, for this reason, because we suffer much less if we understand impermanence, thinking about it is only going to be of a benefit and not of any harm. So every day, if you think about impermanence, it helps you to develop a virtuous state of mind, a wish to do good things, a wish to abandon negative, harmful things. Otherwise, if you don't have that in your mind, it's very easy to slip into laziness. Even though you do, on the one hand, you want to practice the Dharma, you're also lazy. So you feel that I'm going to practice it tomorrow or the day after, or I'm going to do more practice next year. And then we end up never really practicing the Dharma seriously. But if impermanence arises in your mind, then you will feel a sense of urgency. Right now I have to practice the Dharma. I have no time to waste. Now I have a little bit of time today, I'm going to practice. So this is how the thought of impermanence benefits you. You will practice the Dharma. You will give up negative actions. And if you encounter difficulties, you will not suffer so much. You will be able to accept whatever difficulty you find. So if you think about impermanence, it will help you in this life and in all future lives. So how does it help you in future lives? It is because if you think about impermanence, then you are not so attached to this life, and therefore you give up negative actions, you practice virtue, you accept suffering, and that helps you also in future lives. So it's extremely important to think about impermanence, especially now if we are seriously interested in practicing the Dharma. If we do not have impermanence as a foundation, we have really no basis of truly practicing the Dharma seriously. Therefore, in the past, in Tibet, the past Kadampa Geshes saw impermanence as the most important practice. And it is through practicing impermanence that they really found liberation from samsara. And also in the Kagyu lineage, Milarepa only practiced impermanence, really. And through impermanence, he reached the furthest limit of enlightenment. He said himself that in the beginning, out of fear of death, I went to the mountains to meditate. I gave up attachment to this life and dedicated to practice in solitude. And now I have forgot about my fear of death. He had attained the state of liberation. So it's very important to think in this way, because now when we think about impermanence, we should not just think about it in a more broad sense, but think that it happens at any time, at any moment. For example, now you might feel that I'm young and I'm healthy, but that doesn't mean anything, because the timing of our death is really uncertain. We don't know what condition will cause our death. These conditions are always present, always in our face. So it doesn't mean that necessarily when one is a sick person that one is going to die first. For example, there is those people who take care of the sick people, and then there's the sick people. And so that the plan is that first the sick person will die, and then we are going to die. But actually, it doesn't happen according to that plan all the time. Who knows who is going to die first? The helper of the sick person might also die before the sick person dies. Or we think that, no, first the old people die and then the young people die. For example, we have a whole plan in our mind. First, our grandparents are going to die, then our parents are going to die, and then the children are going to die. But it doesn't work like that. It's not so sure. Anyone can die at any time. The young people in the generation can die before the old people die. So it's not so certain. The conditions of our death are uncertain. The timing of our death is uncertain. Old people die and young people die too. We just don't know. So if we know that anyways, if you really understand that, then we will feel a sense of urgency. It's almost like when we understand impermanence, we just can't help but practice the Dharma. So for this reason, it is really of crucial importance to reflect upon impermanence. So then the next verse, number 3, it says, wherever in samsara one is born, true well-being cannot be found. I shall therefore turn away from the worldly pleasures and enter the path of nirvana. So of the 4 thoughts that turn the mind, we have now talked about how difficult it is to find the precious human body, and also impermanence. And now thirdly is the reflection on the suffering of samsara. And so it says that wherever in samsara one is born, there's only suffering, no matter where it is, no matter what body it is, whether it is a human body or the body of a god or the body in the three lower realms. One has no chance to ever find true happiness anywhere in samsara. All of samsara only has the nature of suffering. And therefore, it says, I shall turn away from worldly pleasures and enter the path of nirvana. Therefore, I have no thought of samsara is a happy place. There is no attachment to samsara. There is no clinging to the pleasures of samsara. I know that samsara's nature is suffering. Therefore, I will apply myself in finding methods to become liberated from samsara. So I enter the path of nirvana. So when the Buddha first taught the Dhamma, he first said, first you must recognize suffering. So first the Buddha introduced us to the nature of suffering. Because if we do not understand the suffering nature of samsara, we will also not develop a wish to abandon it. We will not develop a wish to abandon our attachment to samsara. If you understand the suffering nature of samsara, you will naturally develop a wish to abandon suffering. So first of all, we need to understand suffering. What is it actually? We need to recognize what is suffering and then why do we suffer. So when we look at the three lower realms, we can understand that the lower realms are just suffering by nature. But then when we look at our precious human body, we might not recognize that we actually always suffer. We only recognize suffering when we encounter a real undesirable circumstance, when we run into a difficulty or have a problem. That is when we recognize, oh, there is suffering. But we don't recognize that we are always pervaded by suffering, actually. For as long as we are in samsara, we are always pervaded by three kinds of suffering. We are never actually beyond suffering. And sometimes it seems that we temporarily experience some slight happiness. For example, you find that you are healthy, or you have a good job, or you're getting along with your family members. You have many favorable conditions, so you consider that to be happiness. But then if you really think about it, even that is changeable by nature. It will change. One day you get sick, one day you get old, one day you do not get along with your family, one day you separate from a friend that you love very much, and so forth. Or somebody that you love very much suddenly dies, an untimely death, and so forth. And then you suffer. For example, today you're getting along with your family, tomorrow you're not getting along, so you suffer. So whatever happiness you experience today might be completely different tomorrow or the next month or the next year. It happens actually all the time. Even the slightest happiness you experience now really is essentially the cause for more suffering. It never stays, whatever it is. And it always again turns into suffering. So for example, now you are young, but then we all understand the difficulty of aging. And then we look back at, oh, this is how it was when I was young, but now it's like this. So now if you think in this way, if you understand that, you will develop a wish to become free, liberated from samsara. And so now, why is it that we experience so much suffering in samsara? So first of all, we need to see, is there suffering or not? And then when we really look into that, we see, of course, there is suffering, right? There is a lot of suffering. But how do we suffer? For example, when you look at your life, you might find that I'm doing well, I'm healthy, everything is going well. But still, if you look at your mind, you're not always quite happy, are you? You always feel a little unsatisfied, uneasy, even though everything is going well. So why is that? Why do you not feel happy? It is because your mind is filled with afflictive emotions. And because of that, you develop many thoughts of hopes and fears. You always hope that things will go well, and you are afraid that something bad is going to happen. For example, you might be young and healthy and wealthy and everything goes well. Still, when you look at your mind, you're not happy. You're not completely satisfied. You're not at peace ever. And that is your natural state of mind. All the time you feel that way. You never feel completely happy, except for sometimes when you're sleeping, you might feel some pleasure. But normally we are constantly preoccupied with our hopes and fears. And so now, of course, when we encounter a lot of suffering, then that is suffering. But even if on the normal basis there's not a lot of suffering, and the outer level, still within our minds, we never really find a state of being satisfied or happy or at ease. So first we need to recognize the suffering in our mind. And actually when we look at it, we can find that the suffering state of mind is because we have a lot of hopes and fears. Our mental happiness has a lot to do with our hopes and fears. So then when we speak about a mind in a relaxed and peaceful state, we are really speaking about a mind that doesn't have a lot of hopes and fears. So our unhappiness is in direct relation to our hope and fear in our mind. So the greater your hopes and fears, the greater your unhappiness. For example, when we look at a very powerful minister, for example, it seems that he's doing really well, but actually he suffers a lot because of all these hopes and fears in his mind. Or when we look at a rich person, we might think that they don't suffer, but really they suffer a lot because they have a whole lot of hopes and fears. So no matter what happens on the outer level, our happiness is really determined by the hopes and fears that we have in our mind. And so therefore, recognizing that, we should recognize these feelings of hope and fear when they arise and make an effort to eliminate these hopes and fears. And to the extent that we are able to eliminate thoughts of hope and fear, and we will experience an increasing state of happiness and peace. So the greater our hope and fear, the greater our mental suffering. So the masters of the past have said that when we think about the suffering of samsara, it is like we are stuck in a fire pit. For example, if you put your hand into fire, you burn yourself. So once we have taken birth in any kind of body in samsara, it is like we've fallen into a fire pit. And so that is something that we might not be aware of immediately. We might think that we have this really good body and we are healthy and so on. But we are always pervaded by suffering. As a human being, for example, we experience the four major kinds of suffering of birth, aging, illness, and death. So first there's the suffering of taking birth. We should think about that very carefully. The moment the consciousness enters the womb of the mother, suffering already begins instantly. It is just that now we don't know that. We don't know that the consciousness suffers the moment it enters the womb, but there is great suffering. The moment one enters the womb, it is like one is being arrested in a dark prison, like a dungeon. And then one experiences the suffering of growing in the womb, and the moment one is born, suffering becomes even stronger. And then we get sick. So we all know that sickness, pain, is a lot of suffering. So then we suffer when we are sick, or we suffer when other people are sick. And then we are growing old, and there is suffering. That is a lot of suffering too. We know that now. Especially nowadays, actually, there's a lot of suffering that comes from aging, because there's this trend nowadays where people are kind of looking down on the elderly, and they don't take them seriously and so on, and they are neglected often. And then it's very difficult because you don't see much and you don't hear much and you can't walk easily. But then still, the mind is very sharp. The mind still experiences intense suffering. Especially when other people look down on you. There's a lot of suffering. And then there is the suffering of death, and that, of course, is the greatest suffering. And then in between, in our lives, we experience all kinds of sufferings all the time. So in brief, samsara has the nature of suffering, and knowing that, we should apply methods to become liberated from samsara. So we mentioned the four thoughts that turn the mind. We need to turn our mind away from samsara. If we do not turn our mind away, then we will continue to experience suffering in samsara. If we do not understand that samsara is suffering, we will be attached to our suffering, actually, not recognizing that it is suffering. So there's no way out, in other words. So now that we have found the precious human body, we have to recognize suffering and make an effort to apply methods to become liberated from suffering. Because if we don't do it now, then we will be lost in suffering in the future. It is said that the past masters also have said that first there arises an attachment to self, then there is an attachment to others, then there is an attachment to families and friends and our wealth and our possessions. And for as long as we do not let go of that, we will continue to endlessly wander in samsara. So samsara has no essence, its nature is suffering. And so instead of being so attached to samsara, rather we should give rise to minds, thoughts of love and compassion and patience. And actually these practices, love, compassion and patience, these are the very methods to become liberated from samsara. So we should make an effort in developing these qualities in our mind. So now, for as long as we do not recognize the suffering nature of samsara, we will never develop a wish to become free. Only if we recognize the suffering nature of samsara will we develop a wish to emerge from samsara. So recognizing that, we should feel a sense of urgency and make an effort to apply those methods to free ourselves from samsara. We take a break for 30 minutes now.